Well, would you turn in your Bibles to 2 Samuel once again? After today, we'll have only 5 chapters remaining in 2 Samuel. Yes, we will finish 2 Samuel. It's been a while. It's a long book, and we want to take it carefully enough, but can't cover every verse, obviously. Only 5 chapters remain. But it'll be more than 5 weeks, I think, until we finish. 2 weeks from today, it'll be my privilege to be preaching at the annual Tun Tavern Fellowship Retreat. Tun Tavern Fellowship, one of the ministries we support. They have an annual retreat up in Pennsylvania. I'll be there with them that weekend. And then a couple of weeks later, and by the way, that Sunday, we'll have a special guest, Reverend Matthew DeLong, who's the campus minister at George Mason University of their international ministry, RUF International. He'll be here 2 weeks from today. 2 weeks later, I'll be here, but will not be preaching, having been gone all that week at a board meeting. So I'll be getting a couple of weeks out of the pulpit here, and we'll then finish 2 Samuel sometime, perhaps in March. So please continue with me through 2 Samuel, and today we turn to chapter 18. Well, last week we looked at chapters 16 and 17, and we saw that David was still at a very low point in his life at this point in the story. Perhaps the low point we see in these couple of chapters in 2 Samuel. You know, life is full of ups and downs, right? I mean, there's happy times and sad times. There's times of celebration, and there's times of sadness, rejoicing and mourning. David had been kicked off his throne after his son Absalom won over some hearts and minds and orchestrated a coup. But as we'll see here, David still had many loyal followers. Chapter 18 of 2 Samuel, verse 1 says this: David mustered the men who were with him and appointed over them commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds. So we know he had a lot of people with him, and he now divided them up into what we might call battalions or brigades. And there had been some tension, of course, with Absalom, his son, which we've seen over these last couple of Sundays from God's Word. This tension with Absalom, you might recall, began back in chapter 13. We saw that Absalom had killed another one of David's sons, Amnon. Absalom and Amnon were half-brothers. The circumstances were PG-13. I will not repeat those circumstances. But Absalom killed his brother and then ran away. He fled, and he was gone for 3 years. So David had no contact with his son Absalom for 3 years. Then finally, Joab, who was David's commander-in-chief, the commanding general of his army, arranged for a woman from a nearby town. The Bible identifies her as a wise woman. Joab arranged for this woman to come to David and tell a little story that convinced him that he really should allow his son, Absalom, to return to Jerusalem and renew that relationship. So David agreed, okay, let's allow Absalom to come back after being gone for 3 years. But as he came back, when he came back, David refused to even see him. Did not meet with him for 2 more years until Joab finally orchestrated something else to get them together. Actually, Absalom, at his initiative with Joab, got them eventually to meet up together. So you can imagine David, who's king, but also a father. Perhaps he looked out the window of the palace and he saw this little caravan coming with Absalom, his son, and he said, "No, I'm not going to meet with him. Send him to wherever, to this house over here," and for 2 years would not meet with his own son. So Absalom eventually orchestrated a coup after winning the hearts of many people. And so then in chapters 15 through 17, we saw the story of David fleeing from Jerusalem. He fled Jerusalem, and last week we saw that there were a few men who made some very bad choices and were very much against David. Now, keep in mind, anyone opposed to David was opposing God's anointed king. David was God's chosen king. So to oppose David was to oppose God himself. And most of the men we saw in the story last week appear again in these chapters we'll look at today, in chapters 18 and 19. One man who's not mentioned in the story today is Hushai. Hushai, you might recall, was identified as David's friend. And David had sent him back to Jerusalem. He said, go back to Jerusalem and get and be there before Absalom comes into town to take the throne. And then you can sort of, you know, he was going to sort of install him as a spy for David. So when Absalom then returned into Jerusalem, Hushai said, oh, no, I'm loyal to you, Absalom. And that was deceptive. And I, unfortunately and incorrectly, I mischaracterized Hushai as someone who was not a very good friend to David, because although he was being deceptive, he was doing what David actually asked him to do. So Hushai then was sort of being deceptive to Absalom on behalf of David and gave Absalom some advice about how to attack David and so forth. And we'll see that play out today. But we never will see anything about Hushai again in the story. He disappears from the pages of Scripture. We don't know anything about him in history, but at least at that time we know he was actually being loyal to David. So my apologies for misrepresenting him last Sunday. Ahithophel, someone else we saw in the story last week, will not appear this week because he killed himself. Ahithophel was one of David's closest advisors, and he switched sides. He switched over to Absalom and became one of his advisors, and he was the one who gave Absalom the creepy advice to have sex with the concubines on the roof of the palace. So that was Ahithophel. He committed suicide. He's not in the story, but a couple of guys who are in the story today that we must remind ourselves who they were. First, Ziba. Remember Ziba. Ziba was the steward or the caretaker of Mephibosheth. Mephibosheth being Saul's grandson. So the first king of Israel, the crazy king Saul, he had a grandson named Mephibosheth who was disabled and unable to become king. Well, David had appointed this fellow Ziba to take care of Mephibosheth. And Ziba lied to David, double-crossed him, because David, remember, after he escaped Jerusalem, and there was Ziba, who had prepared some transportation and food and wine for David and the troops. And he said, where's Mephibosheth? And he lied to him. He said, oh, he's back in Jerusalem, because he's hoping to take over the throne. Not true. So Ziba lied to David. Then we saw Shimei. Remember Shimei? This guy who appeared to be crazy because as David was marching along with some of his troops, Shimei, this guy comes out of nowhere, starts literally throwing rocks at him, verbally assaults him, calls him a man of blood and you scoundrel and so forth. Crazy because he could have been killed right there because David had his guards with him, right? Remember that fellow Abishai? Abishai, who appears in the story again today. He says to David, should I just kill this guy right now? Literally, he said this, let me go over and cut off his head. Chapter 16, verse 9. We saw that last week. And then we saw David say this. David said, no. He said this to Abishai. No. Quote, it may be that the Lord will see my distress and repay me with good for the cursing I am receiving today. So, this is not an appeal to karma. What he's doing, he's saying, you know, the thrust of the story last week we saw was that we often make bad choices, but God still uses these for good. We make bad choices, but God can still use these for good. And nowhere is that more evident than at the cross of Jesus Christ, right? Nowhere was that more evident, where we see many, many people making very bad choices of their own free will, yet God used it all for good. It was all part of his plan. These people are still held accountable for their actions. Shimei still should be held accountable for his actions, and Ziba, and all of us, but God can still use these things for good. Think about the story of Jesus, and we close with I mentioned this last Sunday, Judas, who betrayed Jesus. That was of his own free will. The elders and chief priests who falsely accused Jesus and had him arrested. They did. Nobody forced them to do that. That was their own free choice. The disciples abandoned Jesus at his darkest hour. That was their choice. That was their free will. The Roman guards who spit on Jesus and physically abused him. Peter, who denied him three times. Nobody forced these people to do these things. They were all acting in accordance with their own free will. Yet God used it. The crowd who shouted, crucify him. Pilate ordering Jesus to be whipped 39 times. The soldiers who mocked Jesus. All these people were acting in accordance with their own free will. And Peter, we see, Peter, who had denied Jesus three times, in the early church then became a leader. And in Acts chapter 2, we see recorded in verse 23, Peter stood up and made a speech, and he said, Jesus, this man was handed over to you by God's set purpose and foreknowledge, and you, with the help of wicked men, put him to death by nailing him to the cross. It was all part of God's plan. Of course, what they did was wrong. They made bad choices, but God used it for good. And he does the same with us today. Even if it's only to see our sin and to therefore come to him in repentance and faith, that is for our good and for his good. So what about Shimei? Shimei, this man who verbally abused David, the king, God's anointed, who threw stones at him. What's going to happen to Shimei now that David's coming back into power, as we will see? What about Shimei? Many years ago, a member of our church recommended that I see a movie. It was kind of a funny movie. He said, Don, you got to see this movie. What about Bob? Well, we'll ask today, what about Shimei? What about Ziba? These guys deserve the death penalty, especially Shimei for cursing God's anointed king. But before we answer the question, what about Shimei, we'll discover to the answer to the question, what about Absalom? What's going to happen to him? Remember now, at this point in the story, Absalom is on the throne. The coup had been successful. He's got all the power. And he follows Hushai's advice and presses the attack on David. Let's pick up the story now, and I'll read just the first five verses for now of chapter 18. We see here David mustered the men who were with him and appointed over them commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds. David sent the troops out, a third under the command of Joab, a third under Joab's brother Abishai, son of Zeruiah, and a third under Ittai the Gittite. The king told the troops, I myself will surely march out with you. But the men said, you must not go out. If we are forced to flee, they won't care about us. Even if half of us die, they won't care. But you are worth 10,000 of us. It would be better now for you to give us support from the city. The king answered, I will do whatever seems best to you. So the king stood beside the gate while all the men marched out in units of hundreds and of thousands. The king commanded Joab, Abishai, and Ittai, be gentle with the young man Absalom for my sake. And all the troops heard the king giving orders concerning Absalom to each of the commanders. Let's pause there for a moment and just get the scene in your mind here. Thousands of troops passing by. Maybe you've been to a military ceremony where the troops march by the general or the commander in chief, you know, pass in review. That's sort of what we have here. All the troops marching past David. So they all saw him, but they knew David was remaining behind. And David had given this order in front of a bunch of troops. Be gentle with my son Absalom, with the young man Absalom, for my sake. Kind of a strange order, isn't it? I mean, they're going into war. But David is still a dad. Maybe he was saying, you know, if he's captured, don't torture him. Or even if he's killed, don't, you know, desecrate his body. Be gentle with him at least. I don't know. But it was kind of a strange order. So here we see a huge battle ensues. But the focus is not on the battle. The details of the battle are barely even mentioned. The focus is on Absalom, and indeed he was killed. The focus is on Joab and on David's reaction. So let me read the next few verses. Verses 6 through 9 of chapter 18. The army marched into the field to fight Israel. Remember, now, Absalom's in charge of Israel's army. So David's army marched into the field to fight Israel, and the battle took place in the forest of Ephraim. There, the army of Israel was defeated by David's men, and the casualties that day were great, 20,000 men. The battle spread out over the whole countryside, and the forest claimed more lives that day than the sword. Now, Absalom appeared to meet David's men. He happened to meet David's men. He was riding his mule, and as the mule went under the thick branches of a large oak, Absalom's head got caught in the tree. He was left hanging in midair while the mule he was riding kept on going. Let's pause there for a moment. What a strange sight. What in the world could have possibly happened here that Absalom would be riding along on a mule? And by the way, the mules were for royalty. So this was normal for him to be riding a mule. Not exactly a large white horse, but they didn't have big white horses back then, I guess, in Israel. So he's riding this mule. Maybe he got distracted, looked aside. His head somehow got caught in a tree. You know, Absalom was known for his handsome appearance and his abundant head of hair. We know that from chapter 14, verses 25 and 26. So probably his hair was involved here, and the author's just making the point that pretty boy Absalom, with his big head of hair, has got it coming to him now. And like I said, mules were the mode of transport for royalty, and as one commentator said, his kingdom went right out from under him. So, kind of a strange scene there, but that's what happened. Now, let me read on. We're not going to read every verse in chapters 18 and 19, but I do want to read at least now these next several verses, beginning in verse 10 of chapter 18. Let's see how the story progresses here. When one of the men saw this, he told Joab, "I just saw Absalom hanging in an oak tree." Joab said to the man who had told him this, "What? You saw him? Why didn't you strike him down to the ground right there? Then I would have had to give you 10 shekels of silver and a warrior's belt." But the man replied, "Even if 1,000 shekels were weighed out into my hands, I would not lift my hand against the king's son. In our hearing, the king commanded you and Abishai and Ittai, protect the young man Absalom for my sake. And if I had put my life in jeopardy, and nothing's hidden from the king, you would have kept your distance from me." Joab said, "I'm not going to wait like this for you." So he took 3 javelins in his hand and plunged them into Absalom's heart while Absalom was still alive in the oak tree. And 10 of Joab's armor bearers surrounded Absalom, struck him, and killed him. Then Joab sounded the trumpet, and the troops stopped pursuing Israel, for Joab halted them. They took Absalom, threw him into a big pit in the forest, and piled up a large heap of rocks over him. Meanwhile, all the Israelites fled to their homes. During his lifetime, Absalom had taken a pillar and erected it in the king's valley as a monument to himself, for he thought, "I have no son to carry on the memory of my name." He named the pillar after himself, and it is called Absalom's Monument to this day. So, pretty boy Absalom's brief tenure on the throne now comes to a gruesome end. No surprise if you've been following along in 2 Samuel. We have a lot of stories like this, don't we? So once again, though, we see the Lord's hand was upon this. Look at the next verse. Now Ahimaaz, son of Zadok, said, "Let me run and take the news to the king that the Lord has delivered him from the hand of his enemies." See, the Lord's hand was in this, and he wanted to be the one to pass along this news. Now, we're going to skip down to verse 28. And I'll just tell you, though, in these next few verses, the author tells us about, you know, there was a disagreement about who would get to bring the news to David. There were a couple of guys who wanted to do this. And in fact, 2 men did take off. They were runners, messengers, and they did take off, and one got there first. But notice what David really seems to care about is not the results of the battle, but he really cares about his son Absalom. Look down at verse 28. Ahimaaz called out to the king. He was one of the runners. "All is well." He bowed down before the king with his face to the ground and said, "Praise be to the Lord your God. He has delivered up the men who lifted their hands against my lord the king." The king asked, "Is the young man Absalom safe?" That's all he wanted to know. Is Absalom safe? Ahimaaz answered, "I saw great confusion just as Joab was about to send the king's servant and me, your servant, but I don't know what it was." So he gives a very evasive answer. He knew what happened. You've heard the expression, "Don't shoot the messenger." Well, he didn't want to get shot, right? I know there were no guns back then, but you know what I'm saying, okay? He didn't want to be the one to say, "Yeah, your son was killed." So he just was like a little, "I'm not so sure what happened. Don't know what it was," he said. Okay, so that's all they wanted to know. Is Absalom safe? So the king said, stand aside and wait here. So he stepped aside and stood there, verse 30. Then the Cushite arrived, this other guy, this other messenger. "My lord the king, hear the good news. The Lord has delivered you today from all who rose up against you." The king asked the Cushite, "Is the young man Absalom safe?" That's all he wanted to know. The Cushite replied, "May the enemies of my lord the king and all who rise up to harm you be like that young man." Verse 33, the king was shaken. The king was shaken. He went up to the room over the gateway and wept. As he went, he said, "Oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, if only I had died instead of you. Oh, Absalom, my son, my son." Absalom was the enemy. Absalom's the one who took the throne away from David. but he was also David's son. I ran into a friend recently who has had some difficulties with his grown children, and he said, you know, you never stop being a parent. It's true. Listen to what he says here. Oh, my son, Absalom, my son, Absalom, if only I had died instead of you. Oh, Absalom, my son, my son. One commentator summarizes this verse this way. It is almost impossible to represent the intensity of emotion in this verse. Throughout this entire episode, David has not once called Absalom son. And now, only at his death, the word comes pouring out from his lips again and again and again. David is finally feeling the emotion of a father, but it's too late. All he has left are memories tainted by bad decisions, regret, and missed opportunities. David was God's chosen anointed king, but right now he's not feeling it. He lost a son. He lost another son. And this is yet another reminder of the dysfunctional family of which David is the leader. The calamity that God said would come upon him. Remember back in chapter 12 where Nathan, speaking for God, said calamity is going to come upon you because of the sin he had committed with Bathsheba. The Lord had said, I'm going to bring calamity down upon you. But with this victory, David will be king again. With the military victory, he's going to be king. He's going to be king over united Israel. Israel in the north, Judah in the south. The throne, the crown, the servants, the chariots, the fine food and the sweet wine. He's going to have it all. And at this point, he does not care about any of that. He's grieving deeply over the loss of his son, his wayward son, Absalom. So David and Joab, his military commander, they won the civil war. And then what? Well, let's pick up the story with chapter 19. Joab, commander of the army, was told, the king is weeping and mourning for Absalom. And for the whole army, the victory that day was turned into mourning. Because on that day, the troops heard it said, the king is grieving for his son. The men stole into the city that day as men steal in who are ashamed when they flee from battle. Imagine that. They just won this great victory. David's going to become king again. David does not care. And the men are moping and slogging their way back into town as if they lost. That's the scene we see here. Let me read on. Verse 4. The king covered his face and cried aloud, oh, my son Absalom. Oh, Absalom, my son, my son. Then Joab went into the house to the king and said, today you've humiliated all your men who have just saved your life and the lives of your sons and daughters and the lives of your wives and concubines. You love those who hate you and hate those who love you. You've made it clear today that the commanders and their men mean nothing to you. I see that you would be pleased if Absalom were alive today and all of us were dead. Now go out and encourage your men. I swear by the Lord, he says, that if you do not go out, not a man will be left with you by nightfall. This will be worse for you than all the calamities that have come upon you from your youth until now. So the king got up and took his seat in the gateway. When the men were told the king is sitting in the gateway, they all came before him. So let's pause there. Chapter 19 is a long one. We're not going to look at every verse. But chapter 19 tells the story of David's return to Jerusalem. His return to the throne. His rightful throne. Remember, he is God's chosen anointed king. And here we see in chapter 19, he comes back into Jerusalem. We see in verse 14 here that he won over the hearts of all the men of Judah as though they were one man. So the southern kingdom of Judah, with its 10 tribes, he won them over. Then he won over the Israelites. So he got back in power and also gaining in popularity once again. But what about Ziba? What about Shimei? Ziba, the liar. Shimei, who insulted the king so vociferously. Are they going to get what they deserve? The death penalty? Or maybe some time in the dungeon? Or maybe they'll get to make big rocks into little rocks. You know, David would have every right to say, hey, Shimei. You know, call Shimei before him and say, remember when you threw stones at me and all the guys around me? Well, yeah, you're going to get to make some stones now. There's your sledgehammer. Have fun for 10, 20 years. He could have done that. So what will he do? What will he do? Let's look down at verse 15 of chapter 19. The men of Judah had come to Gilgal to go out and meet the king and bring him across the Jordan. That's the Jordan River, back into the region where he would be king. Shimei, son of Gera, the Benjamite from Bahurim, hurried down with the men of Judah to meet King David. With him were 1,000 Benjamites, along with Ziba, the steward of Saul's household, and his 15 sons and 20 servants. They rushed to the Jordan where the king was. They crossed at the ford to take the king's household over and do whatever he wished. When Shimei, son of Gera, crossed the Jordan, he fell prostrate before the king and said to him, may my lord not hold me guilty. Do not remember how your servant did wrong on the day my lord left Jerusalem. May the king put it out of his mind. For I, your servant, know that I've sinned. But today I've come here as the first of the whole house of Joseph to come down and meet my lord, the king. Then Abishai, son of Zariah, said, shouldn't Shimei be put to death for this? He cursed the Lord's anointed. David replied, what do you have, do you and I have in common, you sons of Zeruiah? This day you have become my adversary. Should anyone be put to death in Israel today? Do I not know today that I'm king over Israel? So the king said to Shimei, you shall not die. And the king promised him on oath. So David pardoned Shimei. He forgave him. He did the same with Ziba, who had lied about Mephibosheth. Now, some skeptics might say this was just a shrewd political move because, after all, there'd been enough killing. The Civil War was over. He wouldn't win any more people over by killing this fella, Shimei, but he had every right to do that. Shimei, after all, had 1,000 people with him. Not that that was a military threat, but at least showed he had some political support. But if we step back and look at how this story has unfolded over these last several chapters, we see clearly a change in David's heart. We see that he went from a very proud man who was out strolling on the roof of his palace, who looked across and saw a beautiful woman and said, I want her, and sent people to go get her. And she became pregnant, and that began his slow and steady decline. That was the old David. And now we see a man who's been broken, who has everything taken away from him, but now is back on the throne, and we see him forgiving people. Forgiving people who do not deserve it. One of the many lessons we can glean from this passage today is that we also must forgive others. Now, this is not easy. This is not easy, especially if you have been abused. It's not easy in any circumstance, because when you forgive someone who's wronged you, you're literally giving up something. You see, you can't hold it over them anymore. You give up that. You know, if you're one who kind of scores, who keeps score, you know, by points, you know, with your spouse or someone, a friend of yours, you're giving up those points. You can't do it anymore. But we must do this. We must forgive. It's not easy to forgive, but it's easier when you recognize how much you have been forgiven by God. Let me say that again. If you don't remember anything else from this story, remember this. It's not easy to forgive, but it's easier when you recognize how much you have been forgiven by God. David was a different person after he was disciplined by God for his sin. Before all this calamity, David couldn't even stand to be in the same room with his own son. Again, remember that scene. I'm certain he knew Absalom was coming back. He looked out the window. Maybe he looked out the window. He said, no, not even going to meet with him. That was the old David. Now he's grieving over the loss of his son, as wrong as his son was. This is a different David. He's still not perfect, certainly. But before we come to the table this morning, I'd like to answer three common objections, or maybe you could say, barriers to forgiveness that we all might encounter that I think are embedded in this story. And as I do this, I want you to think of someone who has wronged you. Someone who you have maybe having a really hard time forgiving. My prayer is that you will be able to forgive this person and, more importantly, to develop an attitude of forgiveness in your life. Because we get our toes stepped on regularly, right? So we should always have this attitude of forgiveness, knowing how much we have been forgiven. We sin every day, and God forgives us every day. So three objections or three barriers. First of all, I don't feel like it. Well, David didn't feel like it either. David was at a low point in his life. He was emotionally exhausted. He had lost two sons. He'd been kicked off the throne. He'd been deceived by his friends, abandoned, lied to. He didn't feel like forgiving anyone, but that's what he did. I think the Lord is giving us an example here. So number one, I don't feel like it. Well, it's okay. You can do it anyway. Number two, the person is not sincere. The person who I need to forgive, even if they're asking me to forgive them, they're not sincere. Well, you know what? Shimei might not have been sincere. We don't know. We do not know Shimei's heart. And you don't know the other person's heart either. I mean, it seems kind of over the top here. You know, we see here in chapter 19 where Shimei says, he comes and verse 18, he fell prostrate before the king and said to him, "May my Lord not hold me guilty. Do not remember how your servant did wrong on the day my Lord the king left Jerusalem." You've heard the expression, forgive and forget. You can't forget. You can't make yourself not remember something. But he's saying just, you know, don't remember. Don't hold this against me. May the king put it out of his mind. "For I, your servant, know that I have sinned. But today I have come here as the first of the whole household of Joseph to come down and meet my Lord the king." So, was he sincere? We don't know. And you don't know if the other person is sincere. And you really must forgive him anyway, even if they're not sincere. Third, they don't understand. This person who has sinned against me, who I'm supposed to forgive, they don't even get it. They don't know how seriously they have wounded me. In fact, they might not even think they did anything wrong. They don't get it. They don't understand. Well, notice what David did not say to Shimei or to Ziba. Notice he did not say to Shimei, "Let me explain something to you, Shimei. I am God's anointed king. I could have your head cut off right now, and I should have your head cut off right now. I am chosen by God. I am on the throne once again, and you've got it coming to you. See, you don't get who I am." He didn't say that. But there's another more profound example, right? We know, as Christians, looking back on what happened 1,000 years after this story, what did Jesus say when he was upon the cross? He cried out to his Father, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they're doing." And we have to do the same. I am sure there have been times when I have asked the Lord for forgiveness, and I only had scratched the surface of what I really need to ask him to forgiveness for, and Jesus, at God's right hand, interceding for me, has said, "Father, forgive Don. He knows not what he's doing." It's true for all of us. So, if you have a hard time forgiving others, it's because you have not fully understood how much you have been forgiven. Now, I'm not laying a guilt trip on anyone. This is true for all of us. Nobody here fully understands how much we've been forgiven. No one fully gets the gospel. No one fully gets the richness and amazing grace that we all have experienced. We all think we're not that bad. So we don't think we've been forgiven as much as we really have been forgiven. So it's okay that we don't get this. I'm just saying it's a lifelong process to develop this attitude of forgiveness, understanding at a deeper and deeper level how much we have been forgiven. And you'll notice what Absalom said, or what David said about Absalom after he had died. "If only I had died instead of you, David is saying, I wish that I could have died instead of you, Absalom. He was so upset, even though Absalom was such a wayward son and really got what he deserved. You see, what David could not do for Absalom, Jesus did for us. He died for us. He died for our sins. That's amazing grace. And that's what we celebrate when we come to the table, when we look back on what Jesus did for us. Because we are forgiven by God because of what Christ did for us. If we accept him by faith, then he takes our sin and we get his righteousness. See, we stand before God not as self-righteous, but as righteous in God's sight because his righteousness is given to us. It's this great exchange that we don't deserve. So let's celebrate that this morning as we look back on the story of all the trouble that David had and all the troubles that we still have today. Yet knowing we are completely forgiven and knowing that we really should strive to forgive others.